Robert Boyers's new book is The Tyranny of Virtue. It is a collection of essays about the decline of civility and academic freedom promoted by, as Boyers sees it, excesses of political correctness at America's universities. Boyers, who defines himself as a liberal, decries the intolerance of his fellow liberals for political and intellectual diversity. Boyers is the editor of Salamagundi, a professor of English at Skidmore College and the director of the New York State Summer Writers Institute. He will be speaking at a New York State Writers Institute event on Thursday afternoon at UAlbany. The new book is The Tyranny of Virtue, and we welcome Robert Boyers to the roundtable this morning. Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. You are a professor of English at Skidmore College, director of the New York State Writers Institute. What brought you to want to look at this tyranny of virtue?
Well, you know, I've been a professor for more than a half a century, and I've observed all sorts of changes at my own college and across the country. And I began to talk about this some years ago in public forums. And the response was enthusiastic enough to encourage me to write a book.
So how did we get to where we are on college campuses? And by asking that question of giving us a sense of the current climate?
Well, obviously, it's taken a long time to reach the place that we're at right at the present moment. I sometimes talk about the development of what I call a total culture on the campus. All sorts of sort of progressive ideas have been around for a long time and have been supported by pretty much everyone in the liberal professoriate for at least a generation. And those ideas have become, especially in recent years, a kind of an orthodoxy. And they're enforced with a kind of unanimity, which seems to me to run against the grain of the liberal idea. The liberal idea has it that what we ought to be encouraging people to do is to think for themselves as freshly as possible, even about controversial issues, and to speak up about them. On the campus these days, that's become increasingly difficult. It's become increasingly difficult because there is an atmosphere of consciousness raising at every level in which professors, academics, administrators, students, and so on are encouraged to say the right things, think the right thoughts, and to avoid asking uncomfortable questions. You feel this, for example, when there are mandated consciousness-raising sessions every couple of years in which faculty members and administrators are required to come to a room and be addressed by human resources professionals and lawyers, which explain to them exactly the things they are to say and not to say. When the required reading for all freshman students at the beginning of an academic year is a text that's clearly chosen to get students to think the thoughts that they're supposed to be thinking over the next 4 years. This struck me as particularly pernicious at the point about 3 years ago where, at my own college, for the first time, we received online a test, an examination, which all instructors at the college were required to take, a test which would ask them what would be the correct answers to all kinds of questions should those questions come up for them. An example of a question was, suppose that a student came to you and told you that someone had called her a name. What would you tell the student? Would you tell the student this or would you tell the student that? Okay. Suppose a student in your class complained that you had assigned a book by a white author and that the book dealt with the experiences of black people in South Africa. She complained about that. How would you respond? And you get choices to tell you. And of course, if you got the wrong answer, the test protocol would inform you that you had given the wrong answer and give you an opportunity to correct your answer right. and so on.
Think now, about it again.
Yeah, you know, think about it again. All sort of wonderful, but part of an environment, again, in which everyone is required and expected to give the same answers to all the right questions.
Is that what we would refer to as sensitivity training?
I would say so.
Yeah.
I would say so.
So that is how you should behave as an instructor versus the a philosophy, or I'm asking this as a question, mm-hmm. or is it versus a philosophy that the college wants you to espouse?
I think the college wants you to avoid doing anything that might conceivably lead to an investigation, a Title IX complaint,
right.
And a series of perhaps legal questions, legal problems. And of course, all of that is completely understandable from the point of view of a college administrator. But when you put these protocols together with a whole range of other disciplinary actions that are taken at colleges and universities now, you do have increasingly what I call the creation of a total environment, and it manifests itself in 100 different ways.
So let's talk about some of those ways, but I'm interested in what you refer to in the book as a call-out culture, in the sense that anything that would go perhaps to go against what the student believes of an opposing view that they don't want to hear, and this is probably the best example of this, is having a speaker invited to campus who has a politically polarizing point of view. There was a time where we would think of that as a good, vigorous conversation starter on campuses, and now it's being shunned as a way of, no, we don't want to encourage that type of discussion because by doing that, we are giving it some validity.
Yes, that's true. And I think we've all probably read about eruptions on different college campuses in which controversial speakers were prevented from speaking, in some cases with sort of violent incidents associated with these efforts to prevent those speakers from speaking. My own concern, because I haven't witnessed anything like that on my own campus at Skidmore College, never. I've not witnessed that. My own concern is with the call-out culture that exists in virtually every aspect of college life. I'll give you an example. Right? Suppose someone speaks a word which was once, not very long ago, regarded as simply a descriptive adjective. Right, or a noun, which is no longer regarded as strictly kosher. I'll give you an example of a word. Recently, a faculty member in my own Summer Writers Institute spoke the word transvestite. Transvestite. A word that not very long ago and so on was in common discourse.
Right.
That's no longer an acceptable term. And this person who spoke the word was unaware of the change. And that person was called out in the most sort of violent and abusive terms by several young people in our program and so on for having used that term. This is an aspect of what I call virtue signaling. The people who made the call out were signaling their own virtue by very publicly and violently denouncing the person who had used that word. In another instance, a person who was a candidate for a job confused the names of two people. The two people happened to be Asian American, right? That person was denounced for that error, right? And of course, my own sense is that I have no idea what somehow lay behind that error, but I do know that sometimes a mistake is just a mistake. And the unwillingness to allow for that possibility that sometimes a mistake is just a mistake and doesn't signify anything momentous, has to do with this environment of virtue signaling, where the error that someone makes, right, is an opportunity for me, right, to signal my virtue by denouncing that person.
Don't we see this, and isn't this, though, a microcosm of what we're seeing in our culture in general, in the sense that if you go to a theater and, God forbid, your cell phone rings, that you are immediately made out to be, you know, the Antichrist because your phone went off. And sometimes a mistake can just be a mistake. We can be annoyed by it. We can say, okay, I turned mine off. Why can't you turn yours off? But we've lost that empathy. We've lost that understanding. And I guess I think of this, our polarization in politics. I think of our the complexities that we have just of talking about basic things. Isn't this all together? Isn't this part of where we're at right now?
Oh, I quite agree. I mean, the common term forgiveness, just a common term, seems not to be much in favor among many people on colleges and universities. To be forgiving of errors is to somehow suggest that you don't care. You're not sensitive about the injury or the hurt felt by the person who complains. And that just seems to me extremely unfortunate. And again, it has to do with this notion that we know what is right. Everyone around us agrees with us. We've seen to that. Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times wrote not very long ago that in an era in which we're interested in bringing into the university as many people as we can who don't look like us, we are insisting that those people think like us. If they don't think like us, well, then I'm really not happy with them.
Your term in the subtitle of The Hunt for Political Heresies, I mean, the hunt meaning that you're out to get them, right?
Yes.
You're looking for this. You are, your radar is up for the students, maybe for other faculty, that the radar is up to call this behavior out.
Exactly. And sometimes this tendency is associated with the term microaggression. And microaggressions are typically said to be errors or mistakes, which are in many cases unintentional, but which nevertheless hurt someone's feelings. And those microaggressions become very important, are blown out of all proportion. An example, at Harvard University last year, a group of law students mobilized to get rid of the use of the term violation in the law text that they were reading and in the discussions they were conducting on campus, because the word violation itself seemed to them to trigger in some of the law students, unwanted feelings, based perhaps upon their own traumatic experiences and so on. Well, this effort to sort of cleanse the common language of terms that could conceivably hurt someone's feelings seems to me entirely misguided. And it is part of what I am calling, and I don't think it's an exaggeration, a tyranny that exists on campuses. And you see it all over the culture.
Part of that culture and phrases that you hear over and over again, toxic masculinity, white privilege, many others, that are used. But that's the kind of thing that we're calling out now.
Yes.
So what do we do instead?
Well, I think we, first of all, try to develop in ourselves a more tolerant relationship to attitudes and ideas and even expressions.
And let me just interrupt.
Yeah.
And I'm unfortunately interrupting you, but interrupt myself in the asking of the question to say, and I don't mean that there isn't such a thing as toxic masculinity. My question is that we are that radar is up and we're using that description, we're using that phrase, we're using white privilege as a kind of a catch-all for things that may not be a part of that particular definition.
Oh, I agree entirely. I mean, examples aren't arguments, but examples sometimes help to illuminate what we're talking about. At my New York State Summer Writers Institute in 2018, on the last night of the program, a Harvard student enrolled in a poetry class sat down with me at the reception to talk to me about a very unpleasant experience he'd been having in the workshop he was enrolled in. Why? He was a senior at Harvard, a white, very progressive, who had volunteered to spend an entire year at Bryan Stevenson's Slavery Museum in Alabama. Which was, he said, the most meaningful experience of his entire life for this young man. But he had come now to our program after this year at the Slavery Museum with poems based upon his experience over that year. And he was denounced by numbers of students in his class, coming into that class from other graduate programs and so on, for his exhibiting inappropriate appropriation of material that didn't belong to him as a white poet, and for exhibiting white privilege. He had dared, at least, right, to exhibit this in the class.
Not his story to tell.
That expression, stay in your lane, which a number of prominent academics and writers have adopted, have embraced, seems to me to have done a tremendous amount of mischief in the culture.
So let's just talk about that word mischief. So do you think there's something underlying that it's more than just getting the upper hand? And let's say that at very least they're trying to do something good in trying to use your first example, to inform that professor that particular word has been changed and there is now a more acceptable phrase.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the kind of instance that I've just cited, I don't think that there's an educational or instructional mission at the root of the complaint, because the notion is driven by the idea that we are required, each of us, to limit ourselves to the background, the experience, the ethnicity, the gender orientation that we inhabit, so that we're not allowed in that sense to imagine the experiences of people who are unlike ourselves. And that seems to me absurd. There is a very popular Twitter hashtag called Own Voices, in which writers and publishers are called out when they publish a book or a story in which a writer of a particular ethnicity dares to write about the experiences of people unlike him or herself. And this seems to me to entail what I don't have any difficulty calling a kind of censorship. And it discourages younger writers from thinking that they are free to imagine things that don't come out of their own experience. Virtually all of the major writers who come to my summer program in July each year, from Jamaica Kincaid to Joyce Carol Oates, from Russell Banks to Marilynne Robinson, all believe that this is a disastrous and a destructive way of thinking about what is allowable to the imagination.
So it seems, and I got this impression in reading the book, and I understand, and just in our conversation, that basically this can be summed up as there is such a thing as being too progressive.
Well, I think so, unfortunately. That happens, you know, when ideas rigidify into ideology and people sort of embrace those ideas without thinking about what is entailed in doing so.
do you think, and I'm going to go maybe a step too far here, but let me give it a shot, which is, do you think that what we're seeing in our broader political landscape is say the election of 2016 is a reaction to this type of over progressive thought that there is, because we heard it certainly during the election, of the political correctness that often that it's that behavior that is shunned by certain members of our public who say, yeah, okay, I want to say what I want to say, I want to do what I want to do, which is obviously very different from what you're talking about, but they all have seeds kind of in the same place, don't they?
Well, I think that's true. I am a progressive. I'm a left liberal.
Yes.
I have always been so. My magazine, I run a quarterly magazine for 54 years. Anyone who looks at the issues of that magazine knows, that I'm coming at all of this as a deeply disappointed left liberal. In no way do I ever feel anything less than a progressive. But again, there are different ways of embracing progressive ideas, and there are different ways in enforcing what some people seem to want, which is perfect uniformity. And that's where I've sort of found it necessary to become a critic of my own cohort from within that cohort. I want to bring my people back to what I regard as the core ideas of liberalism, left liberalism and liberalism. It is true what you say, that on the political right, the spectacle that we on our side have presented in recent years has furnished them with wonderful material for attacking us and making us look foolish. There's no question about that. When Donald Trump attacks political correctness, he doesn't really understand what political correctness is, because he thinks political correctness is simply a matter of avoiding using disgusting language to describe a person. Now, if that's political correctness, then I'm politically correct. Then I'm all in favor of political correctness. But
basket of deplorables. Let's look at that as an example. I mean, there's something that Hillary Clinton used during the campaign.
Yep.
And it seemed, I understand the point. I get it. It seemed unfortunate.
It was very unfortunate. It was very unfortunate, and I suspect that Hillary Clinton didn't just misspeak at that moment.
No,
I think she actually thought about the people she was describing more or less in that way, and that's too bad, because we know that many of those people that she was describing as a basket of deplorables are people who are having a very hard time, and progressives who are really progressives want to address those people and want to do things to change the lives of those people. The people who are suffering in West Virginia from opioid epidemic and so on are presumably the people that Hillary Clinton was describing in that basket of deplorables.
So, Professor Boyers, how do we make it better?
I think we make it better. I mean, I'm a campus activist, and the best way you can make it better is by trying to get people to think more clearly about what we've been doing, and to acknowledge that many of the things we've said we're doing or think we're doing have not worked out in the way that we proposed they would.
One of the things I found interesting, and it comes really at the end of the book, the very end of the book, where you say this really came out of a lecture of 2015, which is interesting to me, because we think of where we've come over the last 3 years and with the Me Too movement and a lot of people who have become quote-unquote woke, that we think of this as a recent thing, and yet this is something that's been obviously on your radar for a long time.
It has. I mean, I convened a public meeting in New York City at the New School for Social Research in 1993. Mm. It was called The New Puritanism. That's what it was called. And the primary speakers at that meeting were Marilyn Robinson and Orlando Patterson of Harvard University. And And we were confronting things which have evolved since that time. We brought out a special of our issue of our magazine, Selma Gundy, on that very subject in 1994. And believe me when I tell you, when you read the essays of Marilyn Robinson and Orlando Patterson and the others back then in 1994, you could see that they were remarkably looking toward the development of these problems that we now see fully formed before us in 2019.
Robert Boyers is editor of Selma Gundy, professor of English at Skidmore College, director of the New York State Summer Writers Institute. The new book is The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. It is published by Scribner. Robert Boyers, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Again, Robert Boyers' new book is The Tyranny of Virtue. He will be speaking at a New York State Writers Institute craft talk on Thursday afternoon at UAlbany at 4:15 in the Campus Center. You can find out more by going to nyswritersinstitute.org, nyswritersinstitute.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.